So, yeah, very warm welcome, everybody. Particularly warm welcome if you haven't been to these Tuesday night classes before, if you're joining us from the intermediate course. A very warm welcome to you. So if you were here last week, you'll know that we're kicking off a new theme. So the theme we'll be following is Buddhism through time and space. So we're going to be looking at how Buddhism has manifested itself in different times and places, with a view to, well, what can that teach us about how we practice Buddhism here and now? And last week we kicked that off, logically enough, by talking about the Buddha, where it all started. If we're looking at how Buddhism has developed through time and space, where did it start? It started with the Buddha. So last week I talked about the Buddha and about the one thing in the life of the Buddha that actually really kicked off the tradition, the thing that was this sort of explosion of something new in the world, which was the Buddha's enlightenment. So I talked about the Buddha's enlightenment, and I said, I talked about other things as well. I talked about some of the main teachings, but about the Buddha's enlightenment, I said, well, the trouble with the Buddha's enlightenment and saying, what is it? Is that the Buddha said you couldn't describe it. So the whole tradition is based on this enlightenment that we can't really say very much about. And I said at the time, but the way the tradition gets at some of what enlightenment is, it gives us some sort of a feeling for it, or a taste of it, or an inkling of it, is through myth and image. And I introduced some mythic images around the Buddha's enlightenment that I think say something about, speak somehow to us at a level deeper than words perhaps, about what enlightenment is and how we work towards enlightenment. So it might be something deeper than words, but tonight we're going to spend lots of words about it. So tonight what we're going to do is speak about three of these mythic episodes in a bit more detail and what they say to us and what they maybe say about how we can practice and how we can grow and develop. So Satyajyoti is going to kick off by speaking about the episode of the attack of Mara's armies, where the Buddha sits in his aura of peace, despite all this chaos going on around him. Suryamati is going to talk about the touching the earth episode, which is mirrored in our rupa. And I'm going to talk about one that I didn't mention last week, which is Muchalinda, the king of the serpents. Okay, but first of all...
Okay, so chaos in the... calming the chaos that way around. I can do chaos in the calm quite easily, but calm in the chaos. So, as Vidanya's just said, myth in Buddhism, well, I think in all of human life, is really important. Sometimes it tells the truth better than the facts do. Because the truth, as it were, the factual thing, what you could... notice when the Buddha became enlightened was basically he sat a man, a very thin man in rags, a bit of a tramp, sat under a tree, sat there for quite a long time overnight, got up for a bit, walked around a bit, sat down again, maybe it rained, don't know, then he got up again, then he walked around, then he went off. So it was a bit like, that's all you would have seen. And the stories that we're telling tonight talk about his internal experience in a much better way than just observing what happened. They talk about his actual, what happened to him. And I'll just start by briefly setting the context of the Buddha's life. So the Buddha, he led a very privileged and wealthy life, but he decided to leave home, basically to look for the cause of human suffering, to look what it is that makes us suffer. He was a seeker. So he was a bit like... in the 60s, when lots of people would leave and seek for something more, they'd drop out. The Buddha was a bit like that. There were lots of other people at that time who were doing that too. And he set off to seek for the truth. And first of all, he practiced with the best teachers of his time, and he learnt all that they could teach, mastered it, and then moved on. And then he took up some very kind of strong ascetic practices, which basically are things like not eating, sitting the five sun practices, which means you sit between four fires with the blazing Indian sun over your head and get very, very hot. So he like really tortured his body, really. But he realised he was getting nowhere with that, and he made the decision to leave. He'd got a little following by then, and a few other monks had followed him. He decided to leave them and to search for something else. So he went and he had some food from a milkmaid to some food. And he remembered a time when he was being very young and he'd gone into a very kind of positive, happy state of mind. And he thought, I think the secret is going to be somewhere in this. So he sat down under a handy tree and he made a vow. I'm not going to get up until I've worked it out. I'm not going to get up until I've kind of broken through and I can see what it's all about, really. So as he sat, story goes that he was attacked by Mara. So this is a very old, about 2,000 years old? Okay, sculpture. So Mara and his armies, his sons. And his sons are, in the picture you might be able to see, various figures kind of attacking with swords and things like that. Maybe go to another picture. Yeah, so you can see at the top there are figures with swords. So that's Mara's army and his sons. And they could take many terrifying shapes and sizes. So there's some kind of quite old stories about that, some sutras, and they describe how Mara summoned the terrible hair-raising army of his sons. His soldiers could transform their shapes and faces in a million ways. Their heads and hands were twisted and distorted. Their eyes flamed, shining red and flashing. Their teeth sticking out of their mouths. Their tongues lolling, thick and rough like matting. And it's a shame there isn't time for me to go on, because this text is really amazing, actually. I think if you come on Buddha Day, you get to hear all of the text, so that's a reason to come then. But it goes on to describe how they kind of formed all these really weird shapes. Birds with the faces of rams, bodies of men and the faces of cats. Some leapt about wildly, screaming. And basically they tried to terrify the Buddha. So they roared at him. They screamed, grab him, strike him, rip him to pieces, tie, cut, break, crush. Away with Gotama and this foolish tree. And then, as part of their attack, they threw javelins, swords, spears at the Buddha. And it looked, you know, things looked really bad as he just sat there completely unarmed under a tree. But as the swords, spears, javelins got near the Buddha, it's as if he had a force field surrounding him and they turned into flowers. So his aura of calm turned those spears and javelins into flowers, which just gently and very beautifully fell to the ground by the Buddha. Okay, so Mara thought, this isn't working, let's try another attack. So maybe the next one, because that's quite good for... Or even the next one.
Or the next one, probably. Yeah. You can see some of Mara's sons at the top there. This one's
probably... Yeah. So here you can see Mara's sons very definitely with the arrows and things like that. But you can also see some women at the bottom, and those are Mara's daughters. So the next thing that Mara tried was he sent in his daughters, who described as being... Their faces are beautifully painted like flowers in full bloom. Their silky hair was scented with the softest perfumes. Their brows were beautiful. Their eyes were large and lovely as lotus petals. Their teeth was white as shells, and they displayed all the 32 kinds of feminine wiles. I don't know what those are, actually, the 32 types, but anyway. So, and they said to the Buddha, they said, spring is here. The trees are in flower. The time is ripe for pleasure. Come, friend, let us enjoy ourselves. You are handsome. We are well born and well made for pleasure. Here of our own accord, driven by desire. Only a fool would resist such a pleasant, harmless invitation. But the Buddha stayed serene. He stayed smiling. And he said back to the daughters that actually his pleasure is now in the Dharma. It's in meditation, it's in love for others, it's in helping others. So Mara tried with the sons of the army, and he tried with his daughters to try and shake the Buddha, I suppose, shake the Buddha from his purpose. But as the ancient text says, Mara has no foothold in the mind of the Buddha. His body, speech, and mind are all perfectly pure. He is filled with love for all beings. No weapon or poison can harm him. No lust can catch him with its hook. So he envelops Mara and all his followers with a mind of love and compassion. Sitting like a lion, he is filled with love for all beings. And again, and envelops Mara and all his followers with love and compassion. Okay, so that's basically the story so far. What happens next? You have to wait till it's Sri Mati's turn. But so what does Mara represent here? So I suppose he embodies all that calls us away from clarity, from understanding. He represents our fears. He represents the ways that we complicate our lives by looking for the answers in the wrong place. And interestingly, actually, Mara crops up here in terms of the Buddha's enlightenment just before he's enlightened, but he also crops up during, after the Buddha's enlightened. He turns up in lots of different places, and he says things to the Buddha like, oh, these people are really annoying, aren't they? Wouldn't you like to just have a bit of peace and quiet away from them? And what the Buddha normally says is something like, I see you, Mara. I see you. And then Mara, you know, seen through, and he kind of slinks away. But the Buddha always has compassion for Mara as well, which is interesting. So, I think it's interesting that such extreme things, actually, these extreme sort of monstrous figures that attacked the Buddha before his enlightenment, and the daughters as well, happened just before the enlightenment. So I suppose what it's saying is that he's experiencing pretty strong things going on, actually. He's experiencing things that are very frightening, and he's experiencing things that are really calling to him as well, things that he's perhaps, you know, in some ways are attractive to him. But it's his response to his fear, his response to his anger, his craving, that perhaps is different from ours, that he's really developed. What he does is he responds with what's called kshanti. So somewhere here. So that's how kshanti is spelt. And sometimes it's good to use particular Sanskrit or Pali words because they have a specific meaning that is sort of slightly different to any words in English. Because you might translate this as patience, forbearance, forgiveness, which can sound a bit boring, actually. Patience, not exactly. That's not exactly what I kind of yearn to develop somehow. But it's actually not a passive or boring kind of patience or forbearance. So what it is the practice of exercising patience towards behaviour, situations that might not necessarily deserve it. Okay? It's about actually making a conscious choice to actively give patience as a gift. Okay? So it's not a state of oppression that someone's kind of like, you've got to be patient because the bus is late and you've got no choice, you know, or you have to be patient because your boss is really unreasonable and you've got no choice. It's actually you are making a choice to actively approach that situation as a gift, to give a gift of your patience, of your forbearance, in that, of your forgiveness in that situation. So this can be to others, of course, mostly much of the time it will be to others. And there's a very important Buddhist teaching that hatred is never appeased by hatred in this world. By none hatred alone is hatred appeased. So hatred's never appeased by hatred in this world. By none hatred alone is hatred appeased. And obviously kshanti, this forbearance, is a very important part of developing that because it's about how do we deal with other people's anger or things that people do that make us angry. How do we deal with that? The only way we can actually deal with that is with this idea of kshanti, of not developing hatred in response to it. So it means that we might feel anger, we might feel fear, we might feel craving, but we get into that gap that we talk about in the newcomers course. There's a gap we can be in, and we make the decision that we're going to respond to that with patience, with forgiveness perhaps. And I think this idea that we give kshanti when it's not deserved necessarily is really important actually and really strong, because I've noticed in myself I really rationalise. So for instance, somebody's doing something and it's kind of irritating and I'm like, okay, that's all right. And then it goes over a certain point and I go, no, this person really deserves me to be angry with them. Do you see what I mean? It's like I kind of step over a thing and I rationalise to myself and I kind of go, yes, this person, this time, I really need to be angry with them because they really are very bad people. And the same thing in when I'm craving something. So I'll kind of go, you know, happy, happy, you know, dealing with all my other claims. Then I go, this particular mobile phone, because it's gadgets often for me, this gadget really will make me happy for the rest of my life. And this time, I know it will, and I really absolutely have to get this gadget pretty soon, actually. So, I don't know what will happen. But anyway, so it's kind of, so you can see the rationalisation that's going on. I'm kind of thinking to myself, this time the person deserves that I get angry with them, or this time this gadget really will make me happy forever. And actually, it's a rationalisation. That's not true. That's not true. So if I can develop kshanti even when I think it's deserved, so even when I think someone deserves anger, or even when I think something will really make me happy forever, I can still sit in the gap with it and make a decision about whether I need it or not. That is kshanti, and that is going to really help me. We're supposed to be calm in the chaos. And as well as having kshanti with external things, we can also have kshanti with our own mental states. Because what happens is our mental states, our own anger, our own craving, well, they just arise, and they arise because of what we've done before. So if you remember from the intermediate class we talked about, and the newcomers class, we talk about how we create karma, how we actually are creating our future. So if I get angry now, it's because of what's happened to me in the past, how I've reacted in the past. So there's nothing I can do about that. But what I can do is I can do my best to be in the gap and change my reaction. Okay? That's kshanti. That's kshanti. So, yes, yeah, so just like the Buddha was able to turn those arrows into flowers, by our own reactions to what's going on in our own head and externally, we can actually change our response.
Okay, so I'm going to take up the story after the defeat of Mara's armies. And I'm going to talk about an incident that is probably the most illustrated incident in the enlightenment of the Buddha. And it's the incident where he puts his hand down and touches the earth. And you can see that our own rupa on our shrine, and many, many, many rupas all over the world are kind of made with the Buddha making that mudra, making that earth-touching mudra. And in this little sculpture from medieval Nepal, you can just see underneath the Buddha, where he's touching the earth, there are a whole lot of Mara's defeated soldiers all kind of squashed underneath the Buddha's seat. So that one, that illustration is very much about the defeat of Mara and touching the earth. But if you go on to the next one, then you'll see that this just becomes a kind of common mudra for the Buddha to be making in what are often very beautiful and very serene rupas or statues. So if we leave that one there for a moment, and I'll take up the story. So, okay, Mara's armies haven't managed to frighten the Buddha. Mara's daughters haven't managed to seduce the Buddha. But Mara is fairly determined. So Mara next says, "What right have you got to sit on this throne? What right have you got to sit on the Vajrasana, the diamond throne?" Okay, so this is Mara. This is the kind of inward personification of greed, hatred, and delusion. This is the Lord of Death speaking. And I think that this is Mara being the voice of Gotama's self-doubt. His, can I really do this? In a way, it's the last traces of his self-doubt. His grasping and his ill will are being erased by Mara's onslaughts. So Mara is saying that he, not Gotama, should be sitting on the diamond throne. And Gotama asks, because he isn't quite the Buddha at that point, he asks Mara, okay, so who can testify that you've got any right to sit where I'm sitting? And a whole lot of Mara's armies pipe up, I'm his witness, we think he should be sitting there. So this is a very big moment. It's a very dramatic moment. In a way, not only the Buddha's story, but the whole history of Buddhism hangs in this moment. It's a pivotal moment. So will Gotama succumb to self-doubt? And actually, my own experience is that in crucial moments, self-doubt can be very, very undermining. I remember in my childhood, they ring in my ears, these phrases. Phrases like, so what makes you think you're so special? Who are you to think, you know, who do you think you are? You remember, can you visualise teachers saying that to you? It's a technique that people use to make other people conform and do the expected thing, to undermine the confidence to do something different. And that's what Mara's doing. He's trying to undermine the Buddha's confidence. The Buddha, after all, is on the verge of quite a breakthrough. So Gotama's reply, as you know, is to reach down and touch the earth. And he says, let this great solid earth, non-sentient as it is, be my witness. And then the earth shakes, there's an earthquake. And there's thunder, there's a roll of thunder. With 100,000 echoes, it says in the Lita Vistra, which is one of the stories about the enlightenment of the Buddha. And then a new character in the drama appears. The earth goddess Statavara appears, and she confirms. Can you go on to the next picture? Because this is, I really like this one, because on the one hand, on the right-hand side, you've got Mara's armies all attacking, and on the left-hand side, you've got them all retreating. So you've got elephants and attackers all coming towards the Buddha on this side, and on this side, they're all going off in defeat. And underneath the Buddha's throne, there's a picture of the earth goddess. And in the next picture, if you can move it on, there's a rather sexy-looking earth goddess. And of course, I mean, the earth goddess would be sexy, wouldn't she? I mean, you know, she's all about the earth and fertility and all of that sort of thing. So this is the earth goddess appearing and saying, it is as you've declared, Gotama. I've witnessed your practice of kindness, generosity, patience and meditation for countless lifetimes. Okay, so it's a crucial moment for the Buddha. And I think it's a crucial moment for us too. Not only because the Buddha overcame his self-doubts and that changed the course of history, but also because it represents or it symbolises something very important in our own spiritual lives. I think it's an interesting moment because actually the way the story is told in the Buddhist scriptures is very mythic. It's all about battles with hundreds of characters, and the sculptures will show you lots going on around the throne of enlightenment. But actually the simple truth is, as Satchajyoti said, a man sat down to meditate, and he meditated, and at one point he might have actually done that, I don't know, to touch the earth, and then he continues meditating, and then he gets up, and there's nothing much to see. And most of the earth-touching Buddhas, like our own, have their eyes closed. Most of them are expressing not some great kind of battle, they're expressing something that's very inward. They're expressing a deep inner experience. And what that mudra says to me is three things. And the three things are, it speaks to me of confidence. If you're touching the earth, there's something about that that says confidence to me. Something about connection and something about commitment. And those three things together are something that I have learned to call Shraddha. And last week, Vidanya touched on Shraddha a little bit. This talk is going to be about my own experience of Shraddha and an earth-touching moment that happened to me shortly after I became a Mitra, which is very relevant, really, isn't it? The week before the Mitra ceremonies. So, a little bit about Shraddha, which is spelt sometimes Sraddha, and sometimes it's got an H in there as well. And you generally say Shraddha. So as Vidanya said last week, it's usually translated as faith. But it's one of those Sanskrit words, like Kshanti, that faith doesn't quite do it, really. Because it's not faith with connotations of doctrines that you've got to believe. It's not that kind of faith.
It derives from a root meaning to place the heart upon. And Sangharacharya kind of elaborates on that and says it's Shraddha is our response to the values that we place our hearts upon and to the symbols, teachings and people that represent those values to us. And he also says it's the response of our total being to what we place our heart on. So it's not just a heart response, and it's certainly not just believing something or thinking something. It's a kind of total response. It includes thinking and feeling, but it includes more than that as well, a sort of wanting and deciding, commitment comes into it too. And in a way, the earth-touching moment for the Buddha is the culmination of his Shraddha. It's the moment when he could no longer be undermined by doubts. He could no longer be distracted from his goal. And I suspect that when Shraddha is fully matured, it actually is enlightenment. And that's why our own experience of Shraddha is incredibly important, because for us personally, it's kind of prefiguring the enlightenment experience. It's a kind of faint glimmer of enlightenment that we can experience ourselves. Okay, so to a bit about myself and my own path. So, at first, and actually for a long time, for about 10 years, I was interested in Buddhism without being a Buddhist. I learned to meditate, learned about ethics. I actually did meditate regularly over 10 years, but I definitely didn't do Shraddha or anything that could be remotely connected with anything called faith. Because that smacked of religion, and I wasn't going anywhere near religion. I was very solidly, perhaps solidly, rational and materialistic. So I had a decade of practice and sort of semi-involvement in Buddhism before I took the plunge and decided I was going to commit myself. 2002, I think, was the turnaround year. I asked to become a Mitra and I asked for ordination at the same time. So once I'd made up my mind, I really went for it. And during that decade, I'd been meditating. And actually, frankly, it was a decade of struggling with meditation. I, to my great disappointment, didn't get a whiff of the higher mental states that you're supposed to be able to get into if you keep consistently practicing meditation. I had the usual distractions of a very busy life. But even on retreat, you know, even when my meditating conditions were good, then I might get fairly calm, but nowhere near dhyana, nothing approaching anything that I would read about in meditation books. And actually, there was part of me that didn't really expect it. I didn't have the self-confidence for it. I used to think that dhyana was for people who were either clever at controlling their minds or who were very religious, and neither of those things applied to me, I thought. So, I thought it was strange. after I committed myself to the spiritual path, everything changed. My Mitra ceremony was in December, and I think it was the following April or May, I went on a solitary retreat, and bingo, dhyana. I was amazed. And I should put a warning in here. This is not guaranteed to all the people who are becoming Mitras next week, okay? This is just my story about what happened to me. So, what was different? I think part of the turnaround that made me commit to the Buddhist path was that I know more than I know. There was a sense of beginning to allow myself to trust the things that I was hearing about at the Buddhist Center and to test some of the teachings for myself and decide, sometimes grudgingly actually, that I was changing and that the teachings were actually working. I began to take them more seriously and I began to have real confidence in them. And actually, I think this connects us with the Earth Goddess, because when the Buddha summons up the Earth Goddess from the earth, well, what does she represent? I think that the Earth Goddess must represent
the way things are on earth, the way things are in the world that we know, the way things work. I think she represents, in a way, reality itself. After all, you know, our experience is confined to the way things are on earth. That's what we know. And in a way, she symbolises the most basic formulation of the Dharma as it was later taught by the Buddha. And that is pratityasamutpada, or conditioned co-production, or the principle of conditionality. That principle that says that, well, everything that happens, happens because of a whole complex of causes that make it happen. And in a way, the principle of conditionality and the principle of karma are very closely linked. They're almost the same thing. Everything happens dependent upon conditions. So, Gotama had practiced ethics and meditation and wisdom very intensively. Maybe, as the Earth Goddess is implying when she speaks to him in the bit I read earlier, maybe for lifetimes, maybe for hundreds of thousands of lifetimes, who knows? But his practice had been very intensive. So it had been purifying his mind, making his mind suppler, making him wiser, making him braver, making him kinder. And as a result, when he comes to the crucial moment, he's ready to break those last fetters that are kind of binding him to conditioned existence. And he's ready to break off the wheel of enlightenment, the wheel of life, and break through to enlightenment. So, because the Buddha has seen the way things are, he's seen the way that everything arises dependent upon causes, well, he's got the confidence that he needs at that crucial moment to say, I know the way things work. And because I've done the spiritual work, then I'm ready to reap the results. I've done the work, I'm ready to move on and to break through. And that gives me the right to sit on this diamond throne. So in a way, in a much smaller way, it was the same with my meditation practice. When I looked at the facts, I practiced ethics and meditation for over 10 years. I was doing the practices as they were taught. I put myself in good conditions. So on that retreat, when I got calm and focused, I didn't undermine myself by doubting that I could do it. I just reminded myself I could have confidence in the principle of karma. Followed the instructions, I stayed with the breath, got myself into dhyana. It's amazing. I'm sure I could do it every day. it was a real breakthrough for me. So touching the earth is partly about seeing or intuiting the way things really are, and about deriving confidence from that knowing. And so you could describe that as the confident or knowing aspect of Shraddha. But there's more to touching the earth than that. And there's more to Shraddha than that as well. If Shraddha involves our whole being, then it involves our emotions and our volitions, what we want, as well as our knowledge. And the Buddha's touching the earth-touching moment is not just a moment of knowing things. It's actually a moment of deep connection. It's in a way, it's a moment of deep connection with reality, with the earth and everything that lives on the earth and had lived on it and will live on it. I mean, it's a moment of mega connection. In a way, in that moment, the Buddha becomes part of reality itself. Or perhaps he's always been part of it, but he's just realised that he's part of it. Who knows? It's difficult to describe an experience that's indescribable. But the important thing is that he has an emotional response to that too. And his emotional response seems to have been reverence and awe. And certainly when he talks about it later, he talks about, you know, what a Buddha can look up to. And the Buddha can look up to the Dharma. He can reverence the Dharma. He can reverence reality itself. Now, strangely, for a determined materialist, I'd always had a sense of reverence and awe. But I reserved it for the natural world.
and for beautiful things that inspired me. So I would have a sense of reverence and awe at hearing a beautiful piece of music, at looking at the view from Kinder Scout, at watching a marsh harrier skim over a reed bed, at looking at a beautiful picture, all sorts of things, at fireworks. But what changed actually with my commitment to Buddhism was that I began to bring a sense of reverence and awe into my meditation. I'd begun to have a heart response to the Buddha, the Bodhisattvas, to mantras, to puja, and especially to some of the ideas, the Dharma ideas, I was hearing about at Sanghanite and reading about in Sangharachita's books. Had a very emotional response to those. And I'd begun to acknowledge there was something in the universe, actually, that was higher than me, that was bigger than me. And I just loved the thought. And when I sat to meditate, I began to think of myself connecting with something higher. And that changed the quality of my meditation completely. It injected something magic into my meditation that, in a way, has been there ever since. So my meditation is about developing my mind, it's about working on my mental states, but it's also about more than that. It's about connecting with something higher than me. And I think that the fruits of that were one of the things that very strongly prompted my first experience of dhyana on that solitary retreat. So when I sat down on that fateful solitary, there was a different quality to my meditation. I brought the connecting aspect of Shraddha to it, which is sometimes called lucid Shraddha or loving Shraddha, because there's kind of emotional connection there. And then, finally, thoughts and emotions aren't the whole of us. We're also hugely influenced by what we want, what we long for, what we intend. And Gautama, on his quest for enlightenment, was completely, unwaveringly determined to break through to a new way of being. So his touching the earth can be seen very, very simply as just a statement of determination. It's a very stubborn gesture, isn't it? It's kind of, you know, here I sit and I'm not getting up. So this crucial point, he's not going to waver from his purpose, he's not going to get distracted. His determination and commitment is so great that when he touches the earth, he doesn't shake, the earth shakes. There's a great earthquake, according to the mythical stories about his enlightenment. And my own commitment, in a way, started out as a longing for meaning in my life. A longing to be more than the person I was. To be more empathetic, to be kinder, to be more compassionate. To be more able to deal with the ups and downs of life without getting sort of thrown around by them. To be happier, just be content within myself, really. I longed for things like that. And by becoming a mitra, by asking for ordination, in a way I was transforming that longing into action. I was doing something about the things I longed for. I was committing myself to a path that would actually bring me closer to the person that I wanted to be, the person that I longed to be. And I was committing. And commitment does have a magic to it. In a way, commitment changes everything. It changes your whole outlook. Well, it certainly did for mine. It did mine. It sends a message to our subconscious that we're really serious about this. That we intend to act. That we intend to change. It's not just some, it would be nice idea. We intend to do something about it. We intend to move towards the person we could be. So, this longing to change is the volitional, the longing aspect of Shraddha. And it's played out when we commit to something. So, when I sat down to meditate on my solitary, I was a different person from the person I'd been before my mitra ceremony. And the difference was Shraddha. Like the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, I looked the same as before, but there was something that had shifted inside of me. I had the confidence from knowing at some level, at a very small level, a very minor level really, the way things really are. I had a connection with the things that really matter. I was meditating with reverence. And I was committed to growing as a spiritual being. And to be honest, I'm not sure which came first, whether it was the Shraddha or the commitment. But certainly they were connected. And Shraddha certainly transformed my meditation. And I suppose that it's transformed me in many other ways since then. Just as its advanced manifestation transformed the crucial situation under the Bodhi tree when the Buddha reached down and touched the earth.
Okay, so the third episode that we'll talk about tonight actually happened a few weeks after the Buddha's enlightenment. So the Buddha has sat in his aura and Mara's seen off Mara's armies and Mara's daughters. He's expressed his commitment, his confidence through that gesture. And he sat there all night, and this experience has gone on all night. And then we're told that as the morning star appeared in the dawn, I think the dawn is a lovely image for this, he actually broke through to something completely different. So that all happened. And we're told that for weeks after this great experience, the Buddha stayed meditating under the Bodhi tree, absorbing the full implications of the turning about that had come about in the depths of his being. It's as though a great earthquake had happened within him. The tectonic plates of his being had all shifted, and there was a new landscape, and he had to get to know this new landscape. He had to look at all the implications. So we're told that about experiences of great devotion and reverence that Suryamati referred to, reverence for the very nature of things. And we're told about experiences of great gratitude, even gratitude for the tree he was sitting under, again, for just the nature of things, if you like. And we're told how he puzzled about, well, I can't say anything about this. What can I say? How shall I just keep stunned? And we're told about visions that he had that advised him how to approach his life subsequently. And all this went on for weeks and weeks. It took him weeks and weeks to allow his experience to fully work its way out into all the different corners of his being, for the transformation, as it were, to come out from that central experience and completely change him. And for all the implications of what he needed to do to sort of become clear. It took weeks and weeks and weeks. And we're told that the Buddha's enlightenment happened on the full moon in the month of May. And then he meditated for weeks and weeks. And of course, when the full heat of the summer comes to India, something dramatic happens. Something really dramatic happens. As that subcontinent heats up, the air above it rises in these great thermals. And that sucks in, as that air rises, it sucks in damp air from the great oceans surrounding the subcontinent. And then that wet air also rises up in these thermals, created by that hot landmass, and it brews the grandmother of all summer storms. It brews the monsoon. The sky turns black. The whole world goes still. There's a breathless pause. And then the rain comes down in torrents that are unimaginable just about to us. It must rain, it might rain like that in Britain for a few minutes every few years. And it just does that whoomph, as though waterfalls were pouring out of the sky, and it goes on and on. And there was the Buddha, sitting out in the open, just with a tree for shelter, wearing a very thin, threadbare robe. Completely vulnerable to this weather. And even in India in summer, if you get soaking wet, it's not great, it's cold. And at this point, the tradition tells us that the last of the mythic episodes we're going to talk about tonight happened. At this point, so when the whole world goes black, the sky goes black, and the whole world seems to threaten that vulnerable human form of the Buddha, and the first huge raindrops start to fall from the sky, we're told that a being called Muchalinda, the king of a race of beings called Nagas, comes out of the depths of the earth in the form of a huge serpent. And he wraps his coils 7 times around the Buddha to protect him. And he raises his great hooded head over the Buddha's head to protect the Buddha from the rain. And this is an image that crops up over and over again in different traditions of Buddhism. I'll compete with Suryamati. I think this is the most... well, it's the second most common image after maybe the earth-touching mudra. And it's the image of the Buddha and the Naga. So there's one Thai, I think, of the Buddha and a Naga, and a Deva, a sort of godlike figure. So there's the great serpent with these mini heads all on flames. And so another one. There's a more typical one with this hugely powerful sort of snake serpent body all coiled around. And once again, we've got these heads, 5 heads above the Buddha. And here's another one where the Buddha's sort of more sting on the serpent. And the serpent's coming up behind him with his 5 heads, or 7 heads in this case, sheltering the Buddha. And there's another one similarly, where the Buddha, at least you get to see the Buddha, he's sitting on the coils and the serpent's behind his head. And there's a really great one, isn't it? There's the Naga looking really scary. This great big scary serpent creature protecting the Buddha. So the Buddha, enfolded in these powerful, thick coils, muscular coils, solid muscle of the great serpent, protected from the rain by its hooded head. It's an image that carries its own meaning. I mean, it communicates power and strength and a sense of being protected by something very strong, rather mysterious, or very mysterious, rather wild. Something a bit scary that if it wasn't on our side would be definitely frightening. So it's a powerful image in its own right. But okay, what can we say about it? What can we say about what it means and what it might mean about the Buddha's enlightenment and what it might mean to us? Okay, well, it's important for a start to stress that Muchalinda isn't just any old snake. Okay, he's not just a snake. Even if he's very big, and even if he is the king of his kind, Muchalinda is a Naga. Nagas are important figures in Buddhist mythology. They aren't just ordinary snakes. Nagas are creatures of the depths. They come out of the depths. You could say they come out of our depths, or they come out of the depths of reality. They come out of the depths of our mind. Anyway, they come out of the depths, and in various myths and stories in the Buddhist tradition, they bring from the depths gifts. They bring us humans the wisdom of the depths, wisdom that's been hidden until now. Or they bring energy, they bring strength, they bring treasures that have been hidden in the depths, waiting to be discovered. In Indian Buddhist art, and Southeast Asian Buddhist art, and a lot of Nagas are usually shown as being very, very big, powerful serpents, like the ones we've seen mainly. But they aren't always shown that way. In Chinese art, and I think this might be a bit of an example, actually, in Chinese art, Nagas are usually shown as dragons. Great, flying, sinuous, fiery beasts that very obviously the epitome of elemental energy. And these Chinese-style dragons obviously represent the energies. They represent energies of the universe, elemental energies that could be destructive, that could be really destructive if we don't know how to deal with them, but can also be tapped into and tamed. So these Chinese dragons, they also call to mind, they call to my mind anyway, the dragons of our Western mythology, which traditionally often guard great hoards of treasure, which you'll know if you've read about Frodo and the Ring. They guard hoards of treasure in deep places under mountains, jealously protecting their riches, sleeping always with one eye open. and ready to scorch with their fiery breath anyone who tries to sneak in and take as much as a single jewel. So if the Nagas don't respect you, if you're not worthy of their respect, they guard their treasures fiercely. And they will burn you up if you try to steal any of their spiritual riches without earning the right, without putting in the spiritual work that Surimati talked about. But if you've earned the right, if you've earned their respect, the Nagas turn into helpful forces. And of course the Buddha has earned the right. The Buddha has done the spiritual work. The Nagas have great respect for those who are genuinely spiritually developed. And they support them. They protect them. So Surimati and I, we own a reproduction of a Chinese statue, which is, I don't know if you can see that. It's Kuan Yin. It's the Chinese version of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of Compassion. And Kuan Yin is, she's sitting on a, she's standing rather, on a dragon. There's a dragon here. It's coiled around. It's got this great sort of tail. And it's looking, it's got this really fierce face with fangs. And it's sort of looking up at her with this rather sort of respectful, devoted expression, rather sort of like a spaniel. So this image conveys, it's got quite a lot of opposites in this image. Kuan Yin herself looks beautifully calm. Beautifully calm and still. And the dragon is full of movement and energy. It's as though she's moving at great speed, but she's beautifully calm and still. And Kuan Yin has got this really kind expression on her face, and she's reaching out, offering balm to the world. And the dragon looks really fierce, except it's going to be okay to Kuan Yin, because she's all right, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of... This, in a way, I think is expressing something similar. It's a very similar image to the image of the Buddha and the Naga. It's this this sense of combination of calm and energy, this sense of great strength in protection of something that's really worth protecting, this sense of great energy. That contrast between the kind Kuan Yin and this dragon, which is really, if it wasn't on your side, it would be very, very scary and very wild indeed. So the same thing as the Buddha wrapped up in the immensely powerful coils of Muchalinda. So Nagas are energies. They're energies in ourselves, and they're energies maybe even in the world around us. That could be frightening and dangerous and destructive, but which can be transformed and can be at our service. And in fact, that transformation is symbolised later on in the story, because the Naga turns into a beautiful, handsome young man who bows to the Buddha, representing the transformation. So they can be frightening and dangerous, but they can be transformed and put at our service if we do the spiritual work. We've all got tremendous energy. We've got absolutely tremendous energy. It may not always feel like it. Think of the energy you would have if your life was threatened. Think of the energy you have when you're angry. If you can sort of stand back and not be terrified by somebody who's angry, you sort of quite admire it, really. It's sort of, wow, there's some power and energy there. Or the energy you have when you take part in some sport that really, that you really enjoy. The energy that goes into a football game or a game of rugby, it's amazing. And those people are doing all this thing, and it's because they enjoy it. And often this energy only comes out in negative ways that are destructive, like outbursts of temper or powerful cravings. Unless we put in the spiritual work, unless we earn the respect of the Nagas, if we try to steal some of that treasure store of energies, if we let it all hang, our anger all hang out, for example, well, we might well get burnt by the breath of the dragon. But if we do put in the work, the spiritual work, this energy can be at our disposal. If we put in the right sort of spiritual work, we can be as calm as the meditating Buddha, in his aura, that turns weapons to flowers. But at the same time, full of energy, it can be as powerful and full of movement as the dragon. Calm and energy are not opposites we have to choose between. They are opposites that we unite, so that we've got more of both. So I said we can have that energy if we put in the right kind of work. What's the right kind of work? What's the right kind of spiritual work that will give us access to that energy? Well, I think we get some clues from the other images around the Buddha's enlightenment that we've been talking about. So the first image, the Buddha sitting calmly in this aura of light, this aura of peace, in the midst of the chaos of Mara's attack, with all his weapons just turning to flowers. It's a cracking image. Him sitting there in that aura, in the midst of all this chaos and all this negative emotion, is a cracking image for how meditation can be. One thing we need to do is to cultivate the calm of meditation. And when our mind is racing around like Mara's armies, throwing things at us, when it throws all sorts of weapons at us to make us afraid or angry, we see that it's just mental weather. It's just mental weather. Just old Mara, up to his tricks, I see you. And we don't need to identify with those thoughts and feelings. We don't have to see them as me. We don't have to pour energy into them. And in this way, all the energy that we normally pour uselessly, fruitlessly, into negative emotion becomes available to us if we could get it on our side. It's no longer going into the sort of dark tunnels. The naga of our emotions becomes less of a wild dragon. So that's the first thing we need to do. We need to meditate. We learn to stand back from the weather in our mind and to put energy into what's skillful, to see our mental processes rather than be in them, at least some of the time. Put our energy into what's skillful and take it out of what's unskillful. And then we've got that second image of the Buddha reaching down and touching the earth, expressing his great confidence, connection, commitment, groundedness. His Shraddha, his deep whole person knowledge, head, heart, guts, his whole person knowledge that he's on the right track, that he has the support of the world. So if we ground ourselves in our Shraddha, in the sort of way we know, which is not just an intellectual figuring out, but we know it. We know in a way that I can only describe as intuitively. We just know it with our whole being. And if we listen to that voice of our Shraddha that guides us, and if we live from what we know to be beautiful and true, the real values that we hold, with confidence and commitment, then the Nagas start to notice us. I mean, we're usually safe from the Nagas because they don't even notice us. We're too boring. But when we start to have commitment, the Nagas start to notice us. And we start to get their respect. Figuratively, they begin to coil around us and protect us. So they carry us along like they carry Kuan Yin along. So in the words of the German poet Goethe, he says, the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, raising in one's favour all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance which no man could have dreamed would come his way. So the moment one definitely commits oneself, providence moves too. In another word, saying it in other words, the Nagas come to our aid. The Nagas wrap themselves around us and support us. So I think, you know, if we're trying to get some sense of enlightenment, what it might be like, we could combine three images, we could combine all three images. We could perhaps use them in our meditation. We could have that image of sitting in that aura of light, watching the arrows come and just using our shanti to let them turn into flowers. to be as calm as the Buddha. And we can be as grounded and confident and committed as the Buddha in the second image. And we can, if we do that, we can sit also with the power and energy expressed in the last image. And what could have been negative or wild or unruly in our emotional nature, even our animal nature, can be transformed and can give us this tremendous energy. And indeed, the Naga can turn into this beautiful princely being who will shout us.